It's the moment you've all been waiting for, the biggest IndyCar silly season driver story of them all. Scott Dixon leaves Chip Ganassi Racing. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Sometimes you don't even need the joke intro. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 671. Of Motorsport 101. Glad you could join us. And well, this is an IndyCar episode, but also one of the rare occasions where we probably aren't going to talk about the race itself first. We did have a race this weekend. It was the Honda Indy 200 at Mid-Ohio. Unfortunately, everything about it was mid. So it's now the second.
Even the track.
So we had to leave it there, and we'll come back to that a little bit later because, well, all the talk in IndyCar is around one huge story. The literal end of a generation, the end of an era of Chip Ganassi Racing, and something that I never thought I would actually say, Scott Dixon is leaving Chip Ganassi Racing as he heads to a new home, a multi-year deal under McLaren. Now, who would have guessed that 3 years ago? Who would have guessed that 6 months ago? Jesus Christ. Who would have guessed that 3 weeks ago?
Absolutely crazy. That when Jenna Fryer put that out in her Substack.
And we all everyone is like, nah, no way, not possible.
To be fair, a week later, she also thought Sebastian Montoya would be a good fit in a Haas F1 car. So we all just thought she was being crazy again. You know, they can't all be winners, but fair play to Jenna. I've got to give her a due. She was first on this one, and she was correct. I will sit in her giant therapist chair in her office as tribute to the occasion. Joining me, as ever, on this episode of Motorsport 101, of course, is Mr. RJ O'Connell. How's it going, sir?
Oh, don't mind me. I'm just staring at old Kevin De Bruyne on the bench like, oh my God, Pookie Bear. Wait, why is the bulb in the back of our net? And why is this kept happening for the last 60 to 90 minutes of play? Sorry, can you tell them a little bit emotional about the fact that the 2016 Atlanta Falcons actually finished the job in the Super Bowl and gave everybody that was rooting against the proverbial New England Patriots the result that they wanted in this instance? I hope everybody's happy because Belgium is getting that ass spanked pink and red and barbecued by Spain in the quarters.
Yeah, it's
28-3, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, let's just say, as a filthy British football supporter of my own, I'm kind of used to being the villain in 98% of footballing scenarios. So it was actually quite refreshing to see the Americans pick up the baton on our behalf this time around. So, yeah, that was fun.
Everybody that was so upset that Florian Balogun had his red card suspended for a foul that shouldn't have even been a red card in the fucking first place. Congratulations! He wasn't even a factor because he never got the ball!
I personally think it adds quite a bit of lore to this presidency that every time Donald touches something sports related, it immediately rots like SpongeBob's pineapple.
Christian Pulisic wasn't even playing like Mac and Messi. He wasn't even NRA Mark. He was Magar Nacho. I can't even take credit for that, man.
No, but it is still funny.
It is still funny, almost as funny as the President of the United States collaborating with U.S. soccer to get an inadmissible red card suspension overturned without telling anybody. Great way to go, guys. But by the way, we also fined Balogun $40,000 for no discernible reason. Makes sense. Football. We love football. Football, football, football. Watch the football. Watch it. It's going to move.
I think we should ask Mitch McConnell for his opinion on this.
What? Before or after we switch off his machine?
Hang on. All he could say was, it's hot down here.
we don't know yet, okay? Why?
Whenever it happens.
We have not had a Quibi situation on the podcast.
Not yet.
I mean, anyway. We did when I lost Jaylen Brown to the 76ers last week.
I may or may not have put that out on our Blue Sky account. I didn't put it out anywhere else because Cam would have just killed me at that point.
I was about to general frag reverse impact frame you.
Yeah, not ideal.
I'm about to play the ball like 40 yards out of my box and then just like, whoa, wait a minute, guys, what the fuck? The ball is all, it's in the back of my, yeah, now we're down 3-1.
Not ideal. Right, so after this quick interlude and obviously quick housekeeping announcement, we'll get into the biggest IndyCar story of the year so far, Scott Dixon leaving CGR for McLaren and all the ramifications to come with that. And then, of course, we'll also talk Mid-Ohio, as it's funny how these things turn out. The same weekend that it's announced that Dixon is joining the team, the current members of the team, including one of them that we now know is leaving at the end of the season, is one half of McLaren's first ever 1-2 finish in IndyCar, as Pato O'Ward gets back in the winner's circle, his first podium of the year and his first win of the year. For some reason, he just comes alive in Mid-Ohio. Don't ask me how. So we'll discuss all of that and the championship picture, which is now looking a little bit more interesting now that Lundgaard and Pato O'Ward might be right in the thick of that race again a little bit shortly. But places you can find us real quick. If you want to get video highlights of the show as well as bonus content from yours truly, YouTube, Motorsport 101. You're going to get follow us on Instagram at Motorsport 101 Pod and our TikTok page, M101_podcast. You want to follow us on social media in general? We're on Facebook.com/Motorsport101. We're on Twitter at Motorsport_101. And you can also follow us on Blue Sky, Dre Harrison, RJ O'Connell, C Buckley, 917.bsky.com. Social. You can check out our website if you want some more thoughts from yours truly on the Dixon transfer and Mid-Ohio, as well as the Formula One British Grand Prix and all that drama that came as a direct result of that. Also, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. Jason and Ed are doing so right now. Thank you very much for your ongoing support. Right, let's rip this Band-Aid off and let's see what the wreckage looks like. Here we go. Let's talk about the biggest IndyCar silly season news ever, according to some podcaster. Scott Dixon leaves CGR. As much as I don't like Billy Buxton for glazing the ever-loving shit out of this, he probably is correct when he says this is one of the most dramatic driver transfer stories in modern-day IndyCar history. After 25 years, I mean, how many athletes or sports people in general do 25 years of one team ever, period? After 25 years of Chip Ganassi Racing, Scott Dixon heads for a new chapter with Arrow McLaren on a multi-year deal. So that means if that holds up, Dixon will be with McLaren in his age 48 season. Wild. There's also ramifications that come with this too. He's not the only new addition to McLaren's lineup for next year. Reigning Indianapolis 500 winner Felix Rosenquist is returning to the team after 3 years of Mayer Shank Racing as part of the package. Christian Lundgaard and Nolan Siegel become free agents, but following his recent win at Road America and his second place at Mid-Ohio, it's safe to say that the young Dane is now the hottest free agent on the board. Some of the key numbers of Dixon's career so far in top flight American single-seater racing, if you include his starts in kart, 427 starts between IndyCar and kart for Dixon. 58 wins, second on the all-time list behind AJ Foyt, 143 podium finishes. I think it's over 200 top fives, which is just unbelievable numbers. 32 pole positions, an Indy 500 win, and of course, six Aster Cups, 2003, 08, 13, 15, 18, and 20. Again, second all-time behind the great AJ Foyt. Gentlemen, where do we even start with this? I mean, we joked about this. We saw Jenna Fryer was the first to put it out there. Marshall Pruitt kind of oomed and ahed about it back and forth for a couple of weeks on his podcast and Racer.com platform. And then the bombshell hit middle of last week. No, this is actually happening. Scott Dixon's leaving CGR. Well, I mean, what was your first reaction? Cam, you first.
I'll let RJ cook on this one because I'm still processing it, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, look, The whole thing about Boston hyping this up, the sting was already taken out of it when Ganassi announced the first part of it, which was that Scott Bitson was going to be leaving the team in the first place. And that is the most shocking thing of it all, is because Scott Bitson had been at Chip Ganassi Racing longer than any Chip Ganassi Racing driver in the history of the team. He joined the team in June of 2002 because, as some of you may know, Scott Bitson started in 2001 in kart driving for PacWest Racing. By the start of 2002, PacWest Racing is in such dire financial straits that they don't even live to see beyond that year's Indianapolis 500 before the team folds. Scott Bitson gets a pretty nice parachute being hastily jammed into what was then now a three-car Chip Ganassi Racing organization. It was him and their two incoming full-time drivers, Kenny Breck and Bruno Junqueira. And after that, Ganassi defects full-time from kart to the IndyCar series, and Bitson has been there ever since for all six of his national titles, for most of his 58 wins, for most of those 427 starts, 32 pole positions, and the one Indianapolis 500 win. That's
lest we forget as well, pile of sports car wins in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. A couple of Daytona 24 hours. Competed with Cadillac, competed with the HRC Meyer Shank team as recently as this year.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think this would happen, man. I thought he was going to be able to leave the sport with this held up high, but no matter what, it was always going to be with Ganassi. But I'm sure there was a time we thought that the same thing of Will Power and Elio Castroneves went when they were at Penske, and ultimately things worked out a lot different because now they're very different teams. But man, Bitson leaving CGR, I mean, it's been known for a while, but I still can't wrap my head around it, man. It felt like he was going to be there forever and a day. We know he's not the same driver that he once was because Babu Time is still undefeated. I don't think Scott Bitson has fallen victim to the Tom Brady cliff theory, but it's clear that he's not the number one guy can ask anymore. Well, we do know that Ganassi did offer him a multi-year extension, and Bitson said no, wanted to go a different path. So I guess, Trey, why, in your mind, what would make Scott Bitson leave the home that he's known for 25 years to join McLaren? Is it the romance of Scott Bitson, New Zealand racing royalty, going to race for the team that bears the name of another member of New Zealand racing royalty? Or is there something more to it?
I don't know. I mean, for me, like, I'm the youngest of the three of you when it comes to IndyCar fandom in general. But even I was around when it was the target number 9 of Dixon, and that was just an iconic staple of North American single-seater racing. And even though that those days of target sponsoring the 9 car sadly are over, this really did feel like a golden handcuff sort of deal. A Paolo Maldini at AC Milan, you know, the sort of one
Jeff
club
Gordon's
legend.
Lifetime contract.
Yeah,
Jeff Gordon is the only instance of anywhere even close in mainstream motorsport. I could mention Yuji Tachikawa, Toyota Team Seramo, who went 25 years before hanging it up, but I don't want to bore you all with my special interest.
Yeah,
that is basically half the point of this podcast, is to just bore other people with our special interests.
I mean,
that is our brand.
I mean, for me, I look at the situation and I go, well, as RJ quite rightly said, and as Chip revealed in his leaving statement, Chip offered Bitson a multi-year deal. This was not anything CGR had done, at least as far as we know on their end. They were more than prepared to basically see out the rest of Bitson's career, however long that may be. Everything I was ever told was, it's a golden handcuffs deal. Bitson's here for life, basically, until he chooses to hang up the gloves. So the fact that Bitson, and apparently he was in tears when he told Chip this, according to the man himself, this was a several month long decision. I do, a part of me wonders myself why he's done this. For me, and I like to read between the lines on these things, I think it might just be time for a change and maybe one last shot at Ultimate Glory. Maybe he feels like he can't win anything now with Alex Polo in that camp, who, for lack of a better term, has been better than Dixon for the last half decade. Maybe if he goes to another team like McLaren and he can front that team, maybe that might be the avenue for him to have one last swing at success, whether it be a 500, an Aster Cup, or both. It's not the first time someone late in their career has done this. I mean, a lot of people wanted to make the Lewis Hamilton to Ferrari comparison. I don't think it's quite that, mostly because of Hamilton's star power and all the bells and whistles that come with being a headliner at Ferrari. There's a lot more commercial clout that comes with that.
Yeah.
But in terms of prestige and valor, yeah, you could certainly make it. I can certainly see why someone make that comparison. The only thing I've got in sports is Tom Brady going to the Buccaneers. That's what this basically is. It is, I think this is Dixon's final chapter. I don't think he signs another contract beyond the one he's just signed at McLaren. I think two more years takes him to age 48 and one last swing to maybe be the undisputable GOAT of IndyCar. Because he's still a little bit behind AJ Foyt in that regard. I think most people would say Foyt's probably the greatest ever. Although, me personally, I think there is an argument for Dixon. Maybe not a winning one, but certainly an argument. You'd have to have him in the conversation at this point. You know, it's that's
he was a winner. He was a winner, race winner on both sides of the split. Became a champion during the split and then got most of its success after the sport reunified, where arguably from front to back, the level of competition has never been greater. I say this even as somebody that grew up on 90s kart. I'll tell you, from at the very back, even the very lowest of the low in IndyCar nowadays are still better than what you had in the days gone by.
50 wins is an astonishing number. Like, yeah. Alex Polo is like the greatest IndyCar driver of this era, and I think he's got, what, 21, 22? Dixon has 58.
That's insane. Like, and how is only one of them in Indianapolis 500 win, which may also be another draw.
He's led every of plenty of 500s, and he's lost them in every way you might be able to imagine.
Pit lane speed, technical problems, beaten on a final lap shootout,
beaten
by teammates, car airborne, IndyCars like riding the bike, Jay Howard, etc. There's any way you can think of that Dixon hasn't won this race more than once, you can name it and it's on the list somewhere. But for me, like, as the youngest person here, as an IndyCar fan, I just remember Dixon being a fucking Terminator and just thinking,
yeah,
this guy can beat you in every different way you can in an IndyCar. He can beat you on raw speed. He can beat you in a strategy race. He can beat you on a fuel save. He can beat you by going off sequence. He was the constant. He'd be the guy that in a horror movie, you've got to constantly look over your shoulder because you know he's there and you know at any point he can flick a switch. And he's second, and he's going to win this race, and there is nothing you can do about it.
Didn't have a flashy personality for all of it.
Let's not forget when he won that first championship in CGR in IndyCar. That was the debut season for them crossing over.
Yeah, right.
He comes over in 2003 and immediately gets it on the board. He was a road course specialist going in, and he adapted to ovals pretty much immediately.
Right. And in that context, he did it against Penske, who had Elio Castroneves and the late, great Jill DeFerrin, who had a year head start on those technical regulations. And Scott Dixon was just like, you know what? I'll just come in my third full season of doing this and my first time running ovals exclusively, and it won't be a factor. And it'll be so impressive that even though I don't run road courses for another 2 years, Formula One teams still want to hit me up. Not seriously enough to put me in a racing seat, but enough to at least kick the tires, which is kind of crazy if you think about it.
Didn't he test with Williams at one point?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I do remember that correctly. Yeah, I thought that was a thing. Yeah, I mean, that's just the thing. And the thing with Dixon as well, I know it's boring to say, but the longevity. 23 top flight seasons of at least one victory and a streak of 21 consecutive years with at least one win, which is a threat.
Longevity is a boring stat because there's no way to spin it.
It's
just there. If you keep winning over and over year after year, there's no way to hold that against someone unless you're Skip Bayless and you're LeBron James.
Yeah, he was a little bit fortunate last year in this very race at Mid-Ohio when he won last year. It was an Alex Palou charity case, let's be frank. But the win before that at Long Beach in 2024 was vintage Dixon, a classic fuel save off-sequence strategy race where he just, out of nowhere, he goes on the alternate strap, beats the field, and just go, yeah, that's Scott Dixon. He'll just do that to you every once in a while. He very nearly won Mid-Ohio. I mean, that's a Road America last year doing exactly that against Alex Palou and very nearly won that race too, trying to squeeze two extra laps of fuel out of a final stint. And for a second, when we were watching that race on Discord, I distinctly remember thinking, Dixon could still do this. Because you just assume it's Scott Dixon and you assume he can save fuel enough to do it. So when he had to come in for an emergency splash, we were like, oh, fuck. Okay, damn. We were actually surprised by that. Like, he's a genius. There are very, very few drivers that I've watched in my lifetime that are on his level. Just a perennial threat. Year on year, race after race, year after year, literally decade after decade. He is a LeBron James of IndyCar. Like, maybe not the greatest.
He's been doing this for longer.
Yeah, he's been doing it for a year longer than LeBron has in basketball, which is a terrifying thought. But maybe not the greatest of all time, but you can certainly make a compelling case to the years. So it's going to be startling seeing him in a different shade of orange.
Yeah. And also equally startling, Felix Rosenquist coming back to McLaren. If you know
making
the story,
your ex
of,
come crawling back. He's an inspiration to us all.
Yeah. I talked about it briefly in the Indy 500 wrap up. But for those of you who don't know, Rosenquist starts his IndyCar career at Chip Ganassi. He wins Rookie of the Year in 2019. He wins his first race in 2020. But he leaves to go to Arrow McLaren. And Ganassi signs some Spanish kid from Dale Coyne Racing, and that turns out right. But Rosenquist's time at McLaren could not have gone much worse. He was at risk of being sent to the Formula E penitentiary after just two seasons because they are already moving to try and replace him with Alex Palou. Rosenquist practically saves his IndyCar career at the 2022 Indianapolis 500, even though he doesn't win. He is consistently good, but everybody knows he's on borrowed time. And it ends in 2023 with him receiving the unofficial Golden Cock Award from one Ed Hamilton while the two of them are on location at Portland International Raceway. Because that's how badly things went. He rebuilds his reputation at Meyer-Shank Racing, culminating with the Indy 500 win. And then he leaves Meyer-Shank Racing and goes back to McLaren.
From what
this is the one that I just
For what we were told, this was a bidding war between McLaren and Andretti, from what we've been told, and he had already knocked back because like Meyer-Shank wanted to keep him. Like that was abundantly clear. They made a counter offer to try and keep Felix on board. Apparently, Felix got a multi-million-dollar blockbuster offer from somebody. We just didn't know at the time it was McLaren. And when you combine all this news, because obviously McLaren unveiled their full lineup for 2027 in full, of course, Dixon, Pato Award, and Rosenquist with Hunter Ray coming back for the 500 part-time next year. I've said it before, and I will say it again here. It's a lineup that screams, we're all in for the 500.
Is what is missing from their trophy case more than anything in this new era of McLaren. It is coming very close, but no cigar at the 500. mainly with Pato O'Ward. A little bit with Alexander Rossi that one time.
Pato O'Ward has had 8 attempts at the 500. He's been bumped once. He has 6 top 6 finishes at the 500, including 3 podiums. And people will want to deny this, and I don't like it any more than anybody else does, because I'm a filthy European motorsport fan who thinks entire seasons are important. The 500 means so much more than the Aster Cup. It just does. And
we're talking about a guy who just... Why did he cross over from the kart? Why did everyone cross over from kart back in 2002 to 2003?
Milk because
irrespective of everything else, the 500 just means more.
That's the ultimate bargaining chip that they had. The people who were road course specialists were willing to uproot their entire careers for a little bit of time until IndyCar developed their best attempt at a road course package, because the 500, like, you understand, Penske got the ball rolling because Marlboro, their longtime sponsor, literally could not sponsor more than 2 different sporting events at the same time with their budget. Like, that's literally American sporting law. So they had to choose.
Yep, they chose the 500 and won on debut. CGR crossed those lines. Juan Pablo Montoya, he's never going to win anything running that line at the 500. Belt to ass for all 500 miles.
Yeah.
And I think something
a little bit, but yeah.
And I think the timing of this is also relevant, because something that I don't think a lot of people talked about from this year's 500, one, not only did Felix Rosenquist, when he won the 500, had the biggest payout in 500 history, it was $4.4 million. Yeah. The purse went up by 50% this year. It was a $30 million purse. It was 20 the year before. Like, or if you showed up for this race and you were a full-timer, you were getting over $1 million.
Yes.
Like
just to appear.
Just to show up. Like, Malukas got like $1.6 million for finishing second. Now, look, I'm going to crack a couple of jokes here, and anyone who knows this show well knows I have been the biggest advocate for Christian Lundgaard for the last 3 years now. And I've said it before, and I will say it again, he's an elite driver in this series. He has been for several seasons already. I did some advanced number crawling. On road and street courses, since the start of last season, Lundgaard is second in points. He was second on road and street courses last year compared to Alex Palou, and he's been second in that category of racing this year as well so far, as we're recording this after Mid-Ohio weekend. He was 13th on ovals last year. He's 16th on ovals so far this year, and that, I think, is why they've ultimately let him go, because there's no other discernible reason they can think of. Because if McLaren truly gave a shit about the Aster Cup, Christian Lundgaard is their best weapon and has been for a year now.
Yeah. I mean, if that is the case, they probably plug Dixon into the 6 and Rosenquist goes somewhere else. I know there's been sort of an argument of, well, the best oval runner, one of the best oval runners in the sport is in the 5 car. Yes, but you also really would expect Lundgaard to be closer, given we know McLaren can oval as a team.
He did take a step up by default just from getting out of Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanning, and Racing, which we all could have
expected. I could run faster than on a short oval. I'm sorry.
Yes, on feet. No question about it. He's got some top 10 finishes. Like, he's not completely hopeless.
No, right? He's not awful.
He's already got a top 10 at the 500. Yeah, he's just fine.
The problem
he's the number one option to replace Scott Dixon at Ganassi at this point. I think it's there. We are not going to just bury it with subtests, right? We all pretty much acknowledge Christian Lundgaard is the favorite.
He's number one by a country mile here. Like, who would be next in line? It's what Like, it's Christian Lingard is a top five driver in the series, despite being mid at ovals.
He can go work with, as long as Dario Franchitti is still an advisor at Ganassi.
This is my point.
That's a valuable bargaining chip that you can learn from.
This is my point. You stick him in the number nine car right now, already knowing he is a demon on road and street courses, and have Dario mentor him through ovals. You could have another Polo on your hands. That's not an exaggeration. Lingard is that good, in my opinion, because he's a title contender right now, despite the fact he's been mid at ovals this year.
Like, if he has a breakthrough at ovals now while he's still at McLaren before he gets to Ganassi, like if he gets a podium on the board that just so happens to save his title challenge, oh baby.
I think under most circumstances it's laughable. And I still think it's laughable even now we know the full context that McLaren's let Christian Lingard go. The fact that a guy that is third in the championship right now has been told to take a hike is a joke. It is a joke. I can't believe that this is happening at McLaren. Because
their marketing guy is down atrocious for a triple crown.
That's why they're
going to Le Mans.
That is what it is. Yeah. Like,
can I say as well? I know we all kind of acknowledge that Scott Dixon in his mid-40s is not what Christian Lundgaard in his mid-20s. No. I don't think the team is stronger in 2027 as a collective, and I don't think bringing Felix Rosenqvist in is punting on trying to win a series championship.
Look, I think you look at the context of this year's 500 and really most of McLaren's entire season until this exact weekend, ironically.
Yeah.
I'm going to be harsh and say that Felix Rosenqvist is an excellent floor guy. I think he's a top eight driver in the series right now.
Yeah.
I think he's Marcus Ericsson 2.0.
I think that's the best case scenario.
Can I say my piece?
Sure.
Yeah.
If Pato O'Ward wasn't going to be competitive at this year's 500, who's going to be in your equipment?
It's a fair question.
That might be a question asked the fine folks at Chevrolet and General Motors. Because there's that angle, too.
Because
General Motors engine finished about 2 feet behind the win of the 500 this year.
Because the thing is, right, I get why you bring back Felix Rosenqvist, and I think Felix is a better man than me to answer the you up call that Zach Brown clearly sent out. To make this happen. But you did this before. Felix Rosenqvist did 3 years at McLaren and it did not work out. Like, what about your organization now has made you think this is going to work second time round?
Well, you've had multiple managerial changes in the time since you first brought in Felix Rosenqvist, the time you just brought him. You just added Ryan Hunter-Reay, who we know will be back for the 500 next year, as a sporting director. And
what do they even do?
He's really good at it
because McLaren's won back-to-back races since he took the job.
Sure, but McLaren needs an equipment breakthrough in the month of May before they're going to challenge for the 500.
Yeah, right.
Every year, Pato O'Ward goes there and busts his ass.
Yeah.
And every year, he comes up a little bit short.
Yeah.
At some point, throwing drivers at the problem is not going to fix the problem.
Unless the feeling is that, like, Scott Dixon's technical expertise is so good that finally this is what's going to take him over the hump. Because I think with the benefit of hindsight, we agree, Alexander Rossi was a pretty good piece for McLaren at the time, but he wasn't that guy.
Well, I think this is because Pato O'Ward begged and screamed at Tony Kanaan and Zach Brown to sign Will Power, knowing he was going to be a free agent last year, and they ultimately decided to keep Nolan Siegel. So again, what changed in the McLaren organization for them to change tack and go, you know what? All of a sudden, we now think going for the 40-plus-year-old veteran is going to take us over the top. What changed? That's a lot of stuff to know, because he didn't think it was worth doing last year.
One thing that I think changed is that ultimately, I know people will bring up the quote from June 2024 when they first brought him in, but it's 2 years have passed. And ultimately, I think people within McLaren lost patience with Nolan Siegel as a project driver at Arrow McLaren, because it was always a risk to bring him in. I wouldn't fire Tony Kanaan based on that. I will say you are now out of excuses if you don't deliver. There should be some substantial changes in management going forward.
Well, they did last year by getting rid of Gavin Ward.
Yeah.
So
remember when Taylor Kyle was president of the team for a hot minute and then he wasn't?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
if the aim is the 500 and the aim is the 500, they got to break through on the equipment side of the equation.
Yeah.
You know, I have two Indy 500 wins on the board in your team. You have a top two or three person in the world at the Speedway on any given month.
Yep.
You still, like, what more can they throw at this without overturning their whole technical system?
You cannot continue to be the kings of IndyCar's Formula 1.5.
Scott Dixon's your third best 500 runner on that team now. Because Rosenquist has low-key been brilliant for the last 3 or 4 years. At Indianapolis specifically, you now have no excuse. You've got three bullets in the chamber, and you've had a top two car at this Speedway for the last 2 or 3 years. Win the damn thing. Win something. It's laughable that McLaren, with this much money, this much resources, and now a string of really, really good drivers, including Palou Award, who you could make an argument is the second best driver in IndyCar all around. Again, maybe not a winning one, but I wouldn't laugh you out of the room if you made the suggestion. And you've got nothing to show for it besides last year's runner-up trophy. Like, it's time to win something, McLaren. And if this is an all-in move for the 500, fair enough. But in the words of Bob Iger, this better work. But otherwise, heads are going to roll. Because you are not, no matter how you slice this, Scott Dixon's legacy is complete. Yep. No one is going to blame Scott Dixon if he doesn't win a second 500 under McLaren's colors. They're going to look at you.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly. That simple. And
And
quite frankly, like I said, cutting Christian Lundgaard is a joke. Laughable. This better work.
Yeah, because like, I don't agree with the people that are just like, Zach Brown keeps winning. I'm just like, dog, the reason you're in this mess.
Winning what?
In F1, maybe. Not here.
Yeah.
Not right now.
Right. This is the thing, like, that I bring up is just like, I don't agree with Tony Kanaan's decision to replace Christian Lundgaard with Scott Dixon. I also don't think he's been such a problem that he has brought Arrow McLaren down so badly, because at the end of the day, Arrow McLaren has been what Arrow McLaren was before he took this job, which was a team that will give you a few wins a year, come close to a championship and never actually win it, while still being pronouncedly behind Ganassi and Penske.
He's Zach Brown's mouthpiece. You could see it when Bob Pockris for IndyCar on Fox interviewed him yesterday when this was all announced. He was scrambling. Kanaan was struggling to come up with valid reasons for letting Lundgaard go.
Yeah.
We could read between the lines and discern it was the oval form that was ultimately what was accountable for this. And that's barely an excuse. You've let a top three driver in the series walk. Like, if there wasn't a gun to your head already over basically the horrible mismanagement of the number six seat, because let's not forget, you ran out of patience with David Malukas sitting fourth in points right now.
You never even got to that point because they tossed him after injury. That car is in a revolving door.
You've already killed off two elite drivers for this situation. Yeah. That's my point I'm getting at.
Yeah, and ultimately, you only were in a position that you ran out of patience with David Malukas because David Malukas was your backup plan because the guy you really wanted spurned you in historic fashion.
Yeah.
It all ties back to Alex Palou and McLaren. And, well, Palou's just still there, still leading Ganassi, still racking up points and championships.
Yeah.
Yep.
Couple loose ends on this whole thing. They did talk a lot about Scott Dixon's sports car racing experience in that press release. We know McLaren's not coming to the Rolex 24 with its new hypercar next year unless something drastic changes behind the scenes, but make some money by placing a bet on Scott Dixon to be in a United Autosports LMP2 car at Daytona next year. Just
sure, why not? Sure, why not? If he's available and he wants to drive it, why not?
If I'm Juncos Hollinger Racing and I still have two cars or a new investor, I tell Mark Siegel to write whatever check you can that's big enough to buy Stingray Rob out of that contract.
In fairness to Nolan Siegel, he has looked a lot more like an IndyCar driver in the last 2 months.
Yeah. Like, he's not been put in a position to succeed, even though he is bringing a lot of money. Sometimes he has not helped himself. He's gotten better lately. And I still think if he ends up racing in sports cars for the next 5 or so years, that's not the worst thing. Tom Blomqvist didn't work out in IndyCar. And like, hey, look, IndyCar people know that they can't stand when Formula One people punch down at people for not being able to succeed within their sport. Now, do they?
Happens all the time. And like I said, Nolan Siegel is still only 21 years old. He has 20 more years of this if someone wants to invest in him properly. He was thrown in. I'll always have a degree of empathy for Nolan Siegel because he was thrown in at the deep end with expectations being way too high. You're being compared against Christian Lundgaard, Alex Rossi of recent times, and Pato O'Ward. Two of the three dudes I mentioned there are top five dudes in the series. Not a fair fight. It was never a fair fight.
Exactly. And in a situation Juncos, that we now know.
Juncos Ray originally was always the right fit for someone of his talent. Somewhere he can learn and nurture a good oval team. They've got good oval experience in recent years as well. They've had some good results there with Connor Daly and now Rinus VK. A good all-round package. I hope he works out. I hope they can get him over there at Juncos. I think that would be a very good fit for him. We know what Stingray Rob is. He's harmless. You know, he's a good dude, but we all know that he's out of his depth at this level. At least with Nolan Siegel, I've seen enough post 500 this year where I can go, he should be in this series somewhere, just not here. And
because
I think that's
all
fair.
And look, as the guy who was telling y'all that Nolan Siegel was going to be the guy before he won the 24 Hours of Le Mans that ultimately changed the trajectory of his entire career, probably for the worst, bad drivers don't win Le Mans on debut, even if they have to have help to do it.
I'm also very intrigued to see who ends up in the 66 car at Mayer Shank next year, because now
that's Marcus Armstrong.
Marcus Armstrong has signed a new multi-year deal with MSR. He's been moved to the number 60 car. That's going to be his car going forward, headlining that team. A lot of rumblings, apparently, that Helio Castroneves might be pushing to bring in his fellow Brazilian in Caio Collette. Could be interesting. I like Collette. I think he's very quick.
I wouldn't hate the move.
I think he's got a lot of potential. I think he's fast. Maybe I think the results haven't shown it.
Yeah.
But I think he's very quick.
Having an excellent 500 until he very suddenly wasn't. Doesn't erase how fast he was up to that point.
Yeah.
Gateway, he was running P8 when his engine blew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
another case of Alpine Academy common success. Oh, yeah, there was a whole IndyCar race that happened this weekend. Oh, man, forgot all about that. McLaren dominated. Christian Lundgaard took a second pole of the season. That ended Alex Palou's 5-race pole streak as he failed to even make the fast six for the first time this year. Lundgaard led the first 42 laps, but then made a rare mistake when falling lap traffic opened the door for Pato O'Ward to pass him on track for the lead, and O'Ward wouldn't look back as he took his second win in Mid-Ohio in McLaren's first ever 1-2 finish in IndyCar, with Lundgaard in second. Kyle Kirkwood got his first ever permanent road course podium in third after starting in 10th.
How was he able to wait that long?
I don't get it.
I read that and I was permanent
road course podium.
I read that and I was in shock. I was like, Kirkwood's never had a road course podium until Sunday? What?
Yeah, he's been close, but no cigar.
I don't get it. Yeah, and Alex Palou is fifth. His championship lead is left back at 56 points. Adam O'Ward is now back in the title picture.
It's an interesting. You look at the overall scoreboard right now, and it makes for interesting reading. Palou's now got a 56-point lead. He's been dinking and dunking on the rest of the field for the last three or four rounds, and now where he's been keeping it on tick over with top fives after that bad day at Gateway. Kirkwood is now 56 points back after that third place. Lundgaard is now 65 points back in third. Malukas is a point behind Lundgaard on 338. And Pato O'Ward is a bit of the long shot, but he's still just about in the race at minus 94. So I would say it's now a five-horse race for the title. I think New Garden's in P6. I think he's probably just a bit too far back now, realistically.
Also, solid performance for Newgarden this weekend, given he can still barely climb into the car.
P9 on merit. Good drive.
Barely beaten by Malukas for best Penske.
Yeah.
What the fuck happened to Scott McLaughlin?
Well, this weekend his cool suit failed. So
even before that.
Yeah, I don't know, dog. The number one alpha dog at Penske is now eighth in standings, which would be great last year when Penske was an unmitigated disaster. But now it's 2026. David Malukas has a new spring and added a new spring and step to the team. And Joseph Newgarden, despite driving on one good foot, is still sits in points. And this is considering he threw away the Indy 500.
Yep.
It's weird. This is a weird season. I mean, here's my quick observations to come out of Mid-Ohio. Number one, fair play to McLaren. Didn't really put a foot wrong the whole race. They played it ultra safe on strategy. Didn't really want their boys to fight each other. Understandable given the scenario. Shout out to them. Both of them drove really, really well. Shout out to Kirkwood. Going from 10th to 3rd in Mid-Ohio was no easy task, given how hard it is to pass. He had to play bully ball a little bit to get up the field, but once he did, he was quick. We know Kirkwood is becoming an all-round beast at this point. Rinus VK was superb. P4 Dude. For Junkos, no shenanigans, no cautions in this race. Rinus VK was a legitimate speed. P4 on raw speed. That's the VK we know and love from when he won the Indy Road Course race. That's astonishing.
He's 11th in points right now. He's three outside of the top 10 with Marcus Ericsson and both Scots ahead of him. And not by much.
If this isn't the year Rinus VK gets a top seat, I don't think he ever will.
Dude, he's too good. If for some reason Chip Ganassi...
Yes.
Yeah. If for some reason Shank gets cold feet about Colette, hammer the phone to Rinus VK's agent until he picks up.
VK is a genuine three-tool driver, I think, in the right setup. And the MSR car is quick all round. It's quick everywhere. We know VK can do ovals well. We know he's got road and street course speed. He's got a legitimate road and street course win to his name. I think VK's the best free agent on the board, realistically, if Lingard doesn't end up or does end up in the number 9. I think VK is number 2 on the list, and I think he'd be great in the 66. Why not?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, that's a great result. I mean, but yeah, I'm really fascinated to see the dynamic of Aaron McLaren going forward. Now that we know that Christian Lundgaard is not going to be with the team after these next 6 race meetings and 7 races themselves, don't do the thing. But how is the team dynamic going to be when speculation suggests that they will get along for social media posts and all that there may be a little bit of friction behind the scenes, and I just wonder how all that's going to play out as the season draws to its close here pretty soon. We know it's going to be soon. It's IndyCar. They close the shop pretty early.
I've heard rumblings as well that, you know, the same as you, that Lundgaard and Panam apparently don't get along behind the scenes. It's very frosty back there. And I think part of that is just simply put, they're title contenders now. The pair of them.
There's two alpha dogs in the same team.
This is what McLaren, I think, has low-key always wanted. They've wanted someone else that can replicate what Pano can do behind the wheel. Yep. And while Lingard makes his money in a little bit different, in a different way, he's a better owned street course driver than Pano Award is, but obviously not as good on ovals. Ultimately, the scoring's working out about the same. Same as it was last year, where Lingard, again, better on road and street tracks, Pano better on ovals. Ultimately, it works out about the same. So I think ultimately, I don't think there's anything more malicious to it. I just think they're two title contenders in the same team. That's inevitable. Friends don't win world championships. That's how it goes.
Yeah. You only have to look back at the Silver War to figure that out. Scott Dixon's not going to be a Ganassi driver at the end of the season. That's crazy.
It is crazy. Before we go as well, Cam, how do you feel about Alex Palou now? He's got a 56-point lead with, what, 7 to go?
Fine.
I do wonder. I wouldn't be overly concerned, but I did think it's a little jarring that two of Palou's best tracks, he only came away with a pair of P5s. And again, maybe that's
good reason for that last time out. That was like this time. It was very weird that like Palou has been on this fucking war path in qualifying. He was on pole for 50 days and then just had nothing in qualifying. No Ganassi look good in qualifying.
Well, the weird thing was that if he did what he did in round one and round two, he would have made the far six and he would have ended up third on the grid. His
track went away from them.
Just didn't
for whatever reason.
For some reason. I mean, I wouldn't. I'm not. The thing is, right at this point, the clock is the enemy for everybody else chasing him down, because losing rounds to gun him down is going to be the biggest drawback later on. It's Nashville next. Palou was second there last year to Newgarden. Typically, Palou's not the best on ovals. He's not been as good on ovals this year as he was last year. I'll say that much. But
well, he was better at Gateway until the fuel situation happened.
Yes.
But, like, we need to see 500 pretty dominant until the front wing issue came into play. Well, I need to see with Nashville. The thing is, if Newgarden wins, who cares? Like, he's not in the title fight.
Newgarden's not like, a problem. Like,
the worst thing that can happen for everyone else who's in the stakes here is for Newgarden to take win points off the board.
Here's what I would say. It's a weird time because you've got Nashville next weekend, right? That's an oval. Palou was good there last year. We'll see what happens this year. Then you've got three road and street courses immediately afterwards. Portland, Palou's won there before, was third last year. Then you've got two wild cards. You've got Markham, the new Canadian race to replace the streets of Toronto, and then the Freedom 250 race in Washington. I think Palou needs one.
Yeah, if that race is happening.
Yeah, that's next. That's on August 23rd. What I was going to say here is, I think Palou just needs one more real big win to put this away. But don't play with your food longer than you need to, is all I would say.
Here's the thing, though. Alex Palou is playing Uno, and he's got a draw four in the form of Laguna Seca that he can play at any time.
He does. Laguna Seca, it's like him pulling black tires and clean air from the mystery box. You just hear the riff in the distance when you go to Laguna Seca.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I think the biggest thing with Palou, he is the constant. And Kirkwood and Malukas have actually done a pretty good job of being constants with him.
Yeah.
But it's always a different one finishing ahead of the other, and then it's always Palou just racking up points. I think if he can just do what he did last year in Nashville, well, if you lose to Joseph Newgarden, congratulations. You're just like everyone else in IndyCar every year at Nashville.
The problem is Malukas is a fantastic oval driver, so that's going to be... I'd expect Malukas to be in that fight for the win next time around, which, again...
Absolutely. I'd be shocked if Dave Malukas does not get a win on the board this season in what has otherwise been an excellent first campaign.
Absolutely excellent first campaign, but also he's not P2 in points right now. It's that wad of him and Kirkwood and Lundgaard all trading results.
Now awards part of it.
Indeed. On the outside looking in a little bit, but we all know Pato can string two or three of these off when he wants to. And like I said,
you know,
it's any ovals, any oval Pato is a threat. Yeah. We know that. If the car's feeling it, it'll be in the mix.
Got to see more out of McLaren on ovals this year because they just haven't been at the races on them so far.
Fair.
You know, Palou having Portland and Laguna Seca in his back pocket as banker rounds in this championship fight, it's a bit like
Before you say that,
having Romelu Lukaku and Kevin De Bruyne on the bench, but they don't need him because Belgium can just piece up the United States with a kid that only scored 3 goals at glove level last year.
Before you make that point,
you gotta let this go, man.
I've already stopped caring. Like, I'm just back to hating the Red Sox. My only counter to the Portland argument, pencil in willpower for the revenge tour to finally get off the ground before it inevitably crashes back to Earth.
He's so good at Portland, it wouldn't surprise me if Power just wins that one. Like, the three dudes all fighting for the win at Portland last year, Power, Lundgaard, and Palou were the exact three dudes I thought would fight for that win. Shocker, they were right next to each other. Arguably three of the best road and street course drivers in IndyCar straight up. No surprises there. As mentioned, Nashville next for IndyCar. A week and a half's time. It's not this weekend, the weekend after. We'll be back to review that. Next time out, amazingly, just the one episode, but it's a big one. MotoGP and the German Grand Prix at the Sachsenring. Marquez land. I wonder what will happen there. We'll review that next week on Motorsport 101. Until next time, thanks very much for watching and listening. I've been Dre Harrison, they've been RJ O'Connell and Cameron Buckley. Thanks for watching, thanks for listening. See you next time. Take care. Sign out.
Later, y'all.
As long as Palou doesn't start P5 maxing, I think we'll be fine.